have some more thoughts now at week's end about David Petraeus and the scandals swirling around him and the U.S. military. Andrew Bacevich is professor of history and international relations at Boston University, also a retired Army colonel who served in Vietnam. His son, Andrew Jr., was killed in Iraq in 2007. He's spoken to us before about the U.S. military, and we invited him again to share his thoughts on David Petraeus. He joins us from the studios at Notre Dame. So, Professor Bacevich, Andrew, we have in front of us your as-yet-to-be-published op-ed about General Petraeus, which you headline, Architect of Non-Victory. Start with Petraeus, the general, the military leader. You're skeptical of claims of people like former Secretary of Defense Robert Gates, who say David Petraeus will go down alongside some of history's great captains, that he is George Patton reborn.
Well, and the allusion here, of course, is to his presiding over the Iraq surge back in 2007, 2008. And let's be clear that when President George W. Bush appointed Petraeus to command U.S. forces in Iraq, the bottom was falling out. We were staring defeat in the face. And what he accomplished, and it's not a trivial accomplishment, was putting the bottom back in. So that we did not fail utterly, totally, and completely in Iraq. But my gripe is with observers who then characterize that achievement as the equivalent of George Patton racing across France and defeating the Wehrmacht. What Patton, not Patton alone, but what U.S. forces in World War II in Europe achieved was victory. And it's on account of that victory that we look at somebody like General Patton as a great captain.
Because, again, he didn't just push back Hitler's Wehrmacht. He vanquished them.
Correct. Whereas we didn't vanquish the insurgents in Iraq. There is still an insurgency in Iraq. So we should give credit to General Petraeus for averting defeat. But that's a far piece from achieving victory. And victory was what we once expected U.S. forces to achieve when they went to war. The pernicious effect, it seems to me, is that by elevating him to the status of great captain on the basis of averting defeat, the standard whereby we measure the performance of generals had as a consequence been revised downward, so that success now is simply ameliorating the conditions that you confront on the ground. I mean, let's shift our discussion from Iraq to Afghanistan. Afghanistan is now the longest war in U.S. history. If General Dunford is confirmed to replace General Allen, Dunford will be something like the ninth U.S. commander in this war. And in many respects, at least the last four or five of them can claim to have made, quote-unquote, progress. But none of the five can claim to have won the war. And we're now in a position where I think the country more or less accepts the fact that when this war ends in 2014, if the president follows through on his promise, it will not end in victory. My point is simply, that's a problem. Yeah. We should be troubled by the fact that we go to war, we send the forces out to fight, we spend hundreds of billions of dollars, and a decade later, what we have is something other than victory. That's not acceptable.
Well, just to continue the conversation, since we have you, Andrew Bacevich, here to talk in the way that your students probably do with you all the time, so you say this isn't Patton defeating, obliterating the Nazi Wehrmacht. But the insurgents aren't the Nazis. They're sort of this loose confederation of people who have all sorts of different gripes, and part of them have to do with, you know, nationalism and not wanting foreign troops on their ground. Part of them have to do with civil war, sectarian fighting. It's not a group that can or should be, perhaps, obliterated.
Well, I think that's a very fair point. And in a sense, I think my gripe is with the argument advanced by the United States military in the 1990s, during the period of time where, although they didn't know it, they were in fact gearing up for what became the global war on terrorism. I'm just finishing up a book that will be a study of the relationship between the American military and the American society in the post-Vietnam period. And one of the things that I'm going to emphasize are the claims made by the generals after Operation Desert Storm, in which they said, this is what we commit to achieve the next time we go to war. And what they committed to achieve is emphatically victory. U.S. Army doctrine said, there is no standard of success that we will consider acceptable other than victory. It wasn't the politicians telling him to say that. That was their assessment of their capacity to master the art of war. And my point would simply be that, guess what? They made promises they did not fulfill. Now, it could be, as you say, maybe these are circumstances in which not even General Patton could have achieved anything like victory. But I've yet to hear that four-star general who would say, you know what? We misunderstood war. We can't guarantee victory. And to have the general say that seems to me would be very useful as part of a debate before we next go to war, that victory may or may not be in the offing. Now let's have a discussion about whether or not further armed intervention is appropriate.
Well, and you say the problem is that when Petraeus has this glittering reputation, and we've seen how, you know, what part of the glitter meant, you know, the parties and the dinners and the retinue and the followers and the fawning biography, that just keeps this other fact that you are bringing up from being even being discussed, you know, this idea of, well, wait a minute, what is the military, you know, supposed to be achieving? What did you think of that biography at the time?
I have not read the biography. I have to say that just by happenstance, I was watching John Stewart at the time of his famous interview, now famous interview, with Paula Broadwell, and just watching it on TV, there was something that did not seem right in her description of her relationship with General Petraeus as that of mentor and student. Something that just didn't seem quite kosher about that.
This is the interview in which they did push-ups. She challenged him to push-ups.
And there was nothing about her manner or her appearance that suggested an identity of a serious writer, if I may say it that way.
Well, with those push-ups, we should say, were to get John Stewart involved in her work for wounded vets. It worked. He made a generous donation to Team Red, White, and Blue. Andrew Basevich, retired Army Colonel, Professor of History and International Relations at Boston University. When we come back, what's the story involving two admired generals, Petraeus and Allen, what it says about how we evaluate our military leaders. And by the way, later, historian Doris Kearns Goodwin on what all leaders, civilian and military, can learn from Lincoln. That's later, back in 1 minute, here and now.
Funding for Here and Now comes from MathWorks, creators of MATLAB and Simulink technical computing software, accelerating the pace of discovery in engineering and science. Find over 200 job openings at MathWorks.com.
Welcome back to our conversation with retired Army Colonel and Boston University Professor Andrew Basevich about David Petraeus's being forced to resign as CIA director after his affair with biographer Paula Broadwell. Now the story also involves General John Allen and the Florida socialite Jill Kelly, who hosted both generals at parties when they were at U.S. Central Command in Tampa. She also received thousands of emails from Allen, though the content isn't known. Andrew Basevich, you've said why you don't think David Petraeus is General Patton, but explain why you say that although this is a tragic fall for him, it's also an opportunity.
I think that the Petraeus story married to the Allen story shows us that these figures who had come to seem godlike are mere mortals. And because they are mortals as we are, I think it makes it a little bit easier for us to evaluate their performance. And I think that's the good news that may come out of these scandals.
Because you're right.
That we will become less inclined to defer to people just because they wear 4 stars and have lots of ribbons.
Well, because as you say, this elevation of them has meant the message to civilians has been butt out and leave things to the pros. Think tank analysts, opinion makers use this as an excuse to stop thinking critically about war. It sounds like you want to restart that thinking, but wait a second, because I'm sure you don't want the pendulum to swing back the way it was during the Bush era when it was the civilians, the Donald Rumsfelds and Dick Cheneys, who were dictating to people like General Petraeus what they could do. Remember, remember he was banished from Iraq because he wanted to do this counterinsurgency.
I think that's a very fair point, that there needs to be some balance. So there needs to be dialogue. And I would argue strongly that the dialogue ought not simply to be between senior officials and senior military officers, but that we all have a stake in it. So I don't want to defer to anybody when it comes to decisions that relate to war.
You know, personal question, which you have given so much to the military, to the country. But some people are wondering now, Andrew Bacevich, is this what goes on in the military?
I think you're saying, is this what goes on, and correct me if I'm misinterpreting this, but we're sort of back in the parties, the cigars, the
buffet
dinners. Well,
and the people given access to bases, obviously in the case of Paula Broadwell, you know, an affair. Is this, would people be right to sort of say, you know what, it's a male-dominated, powerful organization, the military, this is just what goes on?
It is male-dominated, powerful. I wouldn't argue that the misbehavior that has recently captured our attention, that is somehow routine. There are these eruptions of misbehavior that happen periodically. Back in the 1990s, for example, there was a great spate of senior officers who were guilty of sexual harassment of female colleagues. The one thing I wonder that might be different now is whether somehow or other what we're seeing now relates to what you get when you have a military that is at war for more than a decade. Hmm. We have a generation of senior officers now who have become quite accustomed to exercising greater authority than is allowed them in peacetime. And one wonders if this decade of war hasn't created, in the part of some senior military officers, a sense of entitlement, so that they think that the cigars and the champagne and the parties and the hanging out with the fancy crowd isn't somehow part of what goes along with the job. On one occasion, when Petraeus and his wife were going to Kelly's house, they arrived with an escort of 28 police motorcycles. That's decadent. That's, you know, fall of the Roman Empire stuff. If indeed that sense has developed, that needs to be slapped down.
And how do you teach this? Is this just the story of something that, as you say, happens sporadically, people who fall from grace, Icarus, you know, flying too close to the sun? Is this something that you will talk to students about in a way that has to do more with the military? I don't know. How do you teach this?
Well, I'm teaching it to try to give them a sense of what military life and culture is all about. I increasingly rely on novels and movies. At Boston University, I teach a course called The American Military Experience. We read a novel about being a fighter pilot in the Korean War, for example.
Which is that? Which book is that?
It's called The Hunters by James Salter. It's his first novel. He was a fighter pilot in Korea, and it's quite brilliant. In addition to novels, we use memoirs. I have them read a totally forgotten novel by James Cousins called Guard of Honor, which is set in World War II in a stateside Air Force base and gives you an inside look at what officership is all about and what motivates officers, their ambitions, their fears. So I think in many respects that to me is the avenue to provide students an understanding of what this thing called the military is all about. And I hope by extension equip them to interpret things like the Petraeus scandal and the strange behavior of General Allen.
By the way, you're there at Notre Dame. Your students are at BU. I'm guessing you're in touch with young people in the military. We spoke with Seth Moulton, who was a special assistant to General Petraeus years ago when he was on the outs with the military. He's devastated. You know, he says, I have just a couple of mentors in my life. One was Peter Gomes, the chaplain. At Harvard who passed away. Now David Petraeus, who's fallen from grace. He's devastated. Have you heard from young people in the military? And, you know, what do you say to them?
I have not. Yeah. I mean, I did have this impression that Petraeus, this may sound dismissive, I don't mean it to be, but really had this capacity to attract acolytes, and that clearly they were devoted to him. And there was a time, I suppose, when I felt something of that for senior officers that I worked for. Maybe part of being older and more cynical is that you realize that they are all mortals, and they all have their flaws, and it's important not to, in a sense, become too close.
Andrew Bacevich, a retired Army colonel, professor of history and international relations at Boston University. He has a new book he's working on for next year, but his latest published book is Washington Rules, America's Path to Permanent War. Professor Bacevich, Andrew, thanks as always.
Thank you.
And your thoughts on the meaning of the Petraeus story, let us know at hereandnow.org. Latest news is next, Here and Now.
Support for Here and Now comes from the listeners of WBUR Boston, where the program is produced, by Harvard University, whose Harvard Extension School has online and on-campus courses for students around the world, extension.harvard.edu. And by PBS, presenting The Dust Bowl, a new film from director Ken Burns, starts Sunday at 8, 7 Central on PBS.